Good evening, James McCanny with my Science Hour for January 11, 27, ooh, 2018. I caught myself. I wrote it in my notes, 2017. Don't do that on checks or on other important documents. Put the correct date. Think twice before you speak. That's a lesson for all of you. So January 11th, 2018. Tonight I'll be talking about some upcoming events and my perspective for the future, which is actually fairly bright. But some people are not having it too swell because of natural events, and that is why you have to be prepared. And the people who all of a sudden find themselves in disasters, this is the thing I always see constantly. I mean, I've been in the living in many places in the world, you know, all my life, but also just dealing with people in recovery state after natural disasters. We just had an earthquake off of Honduras, which I'll be talking about in a minute, and also the mudslides in California. But if you had come up to any of these people a week and a half ago, or certainly a month ago, and said, hey, you know, you better be prepared. The sky's going to fall and you're going to be in a world of hurt. These people would have looked at you like you're crazy. Like, yeah, buddy, you know, go sell your wares somewhere else. And all of a sudden, they are, you know, meeting life-threatening situations, and also situations where their you know, the land under their feet is simply not there anymore. The damage in Honduras, they're still assessing it, but it's not as bad as, say, for example, Haiti. I believe the one in Honduras was a bit offshore, but my point is that minimally you should be water independent, have enough food for 6 months. And that's not that hard to do. I used to sell food. There's a lot of people who are in that business now, and with very good products. It was just more than I could handle myself. And there's other people in that business. But the one thing I do concentrate on, the one thing I do well, is with the water filters. And so the sale is probably down by the time this show is airing, because I just haven't had time. I've been very busy lately, and that'll all become more public in a while, but a lot of really good things happening in the background. But you need water. The very first thing you need in an emergency, no matter what it is water. And in fact, everybody has an emergency every day in the United States and many developing countries because of the water problem, the water quality, the water pollution, the fact that you have to get stuff out of your water before you drink it. So be prepared. Have water filter, and you should be using your emergency equipment every day. That's the thing I keep telling people, is don't buy something and put it in the closet and say, well, when the emergency comes, I'll take it out of the box, read the instructions, figure out what to do, and then, no, you got to be doing this all along, so it's second nature. I was on John Moore this yesterday morning, as I always am Wednesday morning, and his prepper tip of the day was to learn how to use a compass. And then we went to break, and I came back and I was going to put an addendum on that. And a lot of people think, like, if you hold a compass and the little needle points to N, that's north. And that's really not the case. It depends on where you are. In fact, a solar storm can change drastically the way the compass reads. If you're involved in a solar storm, you can put that compass out on the picnic table in the backyard and watch the needle move back and forth, because the magnetic field is connected to the plasma magnetic field. which is purely electrical. It has nothing to do with the permanent magnetic field that's in the Earth, and that's what you typically are following with a compass. And there are places like Wisconsin or northern Minnesota and other places on the planet where the geomagnetic field that you read on a compass, that the little magnet in there, is not north. And so you need a map of the area that you're in to see and understand what the anomalies are like on the map, that they're not really pointing to true north. And then you adjust. You have to understand how to adjust for that. Another mention here is something I really haven't talked about in a long time on my webpage, is the calendar, my emergency survival recalendar sunstart clock. This I invented. It's an amazing device, and I'm sure lots of travelers and seafarers and venturers would have loved to have this throughout the ages. It's the one thing we're missing. And now here's another issue. If say in the future there's going to be a pole shift, typically we would not know about that in advance, nor would we know how much the pole shift would cause changes to our orbit, to the rotation of the Earth, to the angle that we tilt with the sun with respect to the ecliptic, that is the plane that our orbit is in around the sun, and then the Earth's axis is tilted, and that causes our seasons, etc. So that affects our clock and our calendar. The orbit is elliptical, so that means that even though the Earth spins on its axis regularly at a certain amount of time, we call that 24-hour sidereal time, star time, not sun time, the day actually changes a little bit during the year. And so you have to account for that. And so my recalendar sunstart clock teaches you all about this, which is really great. And it has all of the data that would allow you to determine our exact orbit and position on December 21st, 2012. And so that would be the winter solstice. At any rate, it's all of the data is there. And so that if, say, we had a pole shift, for some reason a large celestial object comes into the solar system and causes a pole shift, because Earth simply does not jump up and do this by itself. We have had these happen in the past, and they're caused by external agents. Let me just give you a quick example. Imagine a gymnast. A gymnast does somersaults and jumps and spins, and or a skater skating, and then brings their arms in and they speed up their rotational, their RPMs speed up, their spinning rate speeds up. But all of these depend on a frame of reference. The gymnast would not be able to do jumps and flips if it were not for the mat that they're interacting with, or the bar, the single bar, or the all the different devices, the rings, etc. They would not be able to perform if it were not for those that they work against to do their flips and jumps and twirls and whatever else they're doing. So imagine one of these performers out in outer space, and they're trying to do their flips and jumps and twists and spins without anything to touch. They're out in space. There's no way for them to, there's nothing to push against to change their direction or to cause spinning, etc. So they're at the mercy of whatever angular momentum or spin rate they currently have. That's it. That's the end of it, because they have nothing to interact with. And Earth is the same way. This idea that all of a sudden there's, you know, there's more snow in the northern hemisphere, and somehow, you know, people say, well, that would cause the pole shift. No. That's absurd, because in a closed system, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. Newton's second law. So the people that are propounding that have, you know, they just don't understand physics. So the end result is that the one thing you have to know, besides, let's say, water is an essential thing. If there was an emergency where we lost time, where your watch doesn't work, etc., and then I've had people tell me, oh, well, I've got this beautiful, expensive watch. In a pole shift, which I'm not predicting anything will happen, in fact, there's no indication that anything like this is going to happen in the near future. We just know this has happened in the past, and it's going to happen again in the future. We don't know when. Remember that there was a Planet X object in the solar system. It was the nucleus of the comet of Hale-Bopp. If you're not familiar with that research that I accomplished, go to my webpage and look at the DVD. The DVD, the Hale-Bopp 20-year anniversary. It was released July 23rd, 2015, which was the 20th anniversary of the discovery of Hale-Bopp. The official discovery, because Hale-Bopp was discovered early in the 1990s by the Naval Observatory under a contract from NASA called the Search for Planet X. And they indeed find that, and it was the nucleus of Hale-Bopp. So that whole story is explained in my DVD. And, of course, you're not going to hear that in the mainstream news, and you're certainly not going to hear that from any scientist at NASA, because they are Tier 2 scientists. They're not privy to information that is real. Their job is to obfuscate reality. That's what they're paid to do. Anyway, I'm getting a little bit off topic here, but the Emergency Survival Recalendar Sun-Star Clock allows you to change if there is such an event, and it would allow somebody in the future digging up this plate. Say 10,000 years from now, somebody digs one of these up and looks at it, they would be able to tell and put a timeline on our culture as of 2012. And I picked that date because that's when I released that particular product, not having anything to do with the 2012 fantasy, you know, disaster, everybody's going to die scenario that was being propounded, and something that I said all along was just a farce, that people were using that was a big CIA-promoted disinformation campaign, just like the year 2000. You know, remember the Millennium Bug? All the computers were supposed to crash, and none of them did. So just another farce of a story. But my Recalendar Sun-Star Clock allows you to understand time relative to the sun and the motion of the Earth. So, for a very low price there, in fact, I think it's $39 on my webpage. Go check that out. But being ready for an emergency simply means being able to take care of yourself. And if you're not prepared to take care of yourself in all respects, then you could have some serious problems. It's just a very important issue. Be prepared. Water, food, shelter, and a place to go to in some cases. Okay, so on to the California mudslide. I got some on-site reporting because I really didn't quite understand from the news reports that were coming out. I did not quite understand what was going on, but here's the story as I got it from some people who live in that area. The fires that raged through there during the drought, this is north and east of Los Angeles up in the hills, once the ground is barren, basically, all of the brush and the trees burned off, then come the rains. And so apparently the story is that these people were warned, they told them to get out of there, that the rains were coming and they were expecting problems, serious problems, including the mudslides. And so a lot of people simply didn't listen. They just stayed there and then they ended up in trouble. And so that took a lot of heroic efforts from rescue teams, et cetera, to go in and save them. So that's my understanding from, like I say, inside sources. There's a dam up there. I talked about that on a previous show, that once the rains begin, the footings of the dam are coming. I believe that was outside of Fresno, and there was a danger of that dam bursting and washing, just literally washing some of those valley cities off the map. But we do live in certain volatile times. The earthquake this Tuesday in Honduras, a 7.6, which was larger than the Haiti earthquake of a number of years ago. The Haiti earthquake was a 7.0, but it appears that the Haiti earthquake, there was a lot more damage, probably because of, even though both countries would be considered third world countries, the amount of reported damage, at least at this time, seems to be a lot less in Honduras. But if you remember, I had the the misfortune, if you want to call it that, of being bounced around myself in the Ecuador earthquakes a couple years ago. And that was quite an experience. If you remember, I was taking a shower at the time one of them hit. And so here I am, you know, in a shower with soap all over the place and a slippery tile floor, being bounced back and forth against the walls of the shower. The lights go out. I grab a towel. I was able to find a towel and ended up running out and getting all the way to outside the street, where by the time I got there, the people were filling the streets from the local, you know, the neighborhood, so to speak. And here I am soaking wet, full of soap, with a towel wrapped around me. So anyway, yeah, the earthquakes don't give you time to prepare. And there's nothing more upsetting than the earth shaking under your feet, let me tell you. And then they continued. And I was in a Vantage Point where that occurred. And there was a lot of times light, it's like a kind of like heat lightning occurring down off the coast. So it was very near the coast where I was at. And the heat lightning occurring off the coast, and just like this glowing, flashing phenomenon down off of the coast where the earthquake was occurring. All of these earthquakes were right along the coastline. But anyway, and that was a whole series of special programs, etc., I did about that time a couple years ago. But yeah, when the ground starts shaking under your feet, let me tell you, there is. I used to live in the Caribbean, and there were places there, like Puerto Rico, that had 11 or 12 earthquakes per day, but they were little, and that was one thing that's kept Puerto Rico from having major earthquakes. Is the Puerto Rican Trench is right there, one of the deepest drop-offs in the ocean in the world, and it moves and slips and slides a dozen times per day, so it doesn't build up for the big one. And that's the problem with the San Andreas and the San Madrid and the lot of the Andean plates, where they build up pressure and all of a sudden make a big slip and cause a major earthquake. So anyway, I don't have any direct reporting from Honduras other than, like what I said, it seems that the amount of damage there was not as extensive as one might expect from a 7.6 earthquake. Another, excuse me, another little topic here. This past week, a new world record. No, I guess this is not the biggest prime number. It's simply a new prime number was discovered with greater than 23 million digits. And they say it was discovered, they give the discovery to the guy whose computer was crunching the last digits in his home computer when the discovery was made. So they give it to this guy, even though thousands and thousands of people's computers were used in this process, but this is a way to gather fanfare for the Electronic Computing Association. It's like a little prize they give out, and I don't know how much they give, actually some money. But this guy was a FedEx employee, and he had donated his home computer time to this effort. And allegedly, he had been teaching mathematics for many years, so it was kind of like interesting. He wasn't just a guy off the street who donated his computer time. He was also interested in mathematics, so this was like a kind of a thrill for this guy. But what they don't tell you is that the discovery really has very little meaning. What they do is they take a big number, and they're called Mersenne primes, and they have the property that they are 2 to the n plus 1. And so that's just the definition of a number that has a possibility of being prime. It doesn't mean it is prime. And when I discovered my work on calculating prime numbers directly, one of the things I understood is why Mersenne primes are potential primes. But my work does a lot more to narrow down the prime numbers and isolate them very quickly. It's very interesting. So when my book came out, it was 2007, the Electronic Computing Association changed their rules, and they said that any prime number discoveries that they were going to acknowledge had to use the computing algorithm that they set forth, which is this brute force: take a number, divide it by the prime numbers up to the square root of the number, and if none of them produce a factor that is an integer, in other words, all of the factors turn out to have fractional parts, then they discover a prime number. But it gives you absolutely no understanding of where the next one might be. In fact, I got an email from somebody that said, does this prime number, this new prime number, have a twin prime mate? In other words, and I jokingly replied by saying, add and subtract 2. Because either it's the lesser of the two numbers of the twin prime pair, or it is the greater of the pair. And so if it's the greater, you would subtract 2. If it was the lesser, you would add 2. But that doesn't mean that that number is a prime number. You'd have to go through this whole rigmarole of dividing by all of the prime numbers up to the square root of that number, except that's the brute force method. That's not my method. And so with my method, the prime numbers are calculated in groups. And as you go through this process, the groups get bigger and bigger and bigger. And so, let's talk about infinity and the true understanding of infinity. Now, when these people tell you a number, this is a number with 23 million digits, you know, compared to infinity, that's a very, very small number. In fact, any number is a small number compared to infinity. Infinity is beyond, if you took this number and multiplied it by itself, you would get a number with of like 46 million digits, something like that. But is that a big number? Even though it's not a prime number, it's a big number, but relative to infinity, once again, it's not a big number. So these people trying to, and especially mathematicians, should know better. Anybody trying to wow you that this is somehow a big number is ludicrous. It's not a big number. And the real issue, though, is that it provides no understanding. To go start finding the next biggest prime number or another big prime number, you have to just start all over again. So it's not it doesn't accomplish anything. It doesn't give you understanding. And mathematics should be about understanding, not just brute force calculations. And that's what happened with my book, Calculate Primes. I put the prime numbers in order. And there's a major resistance in the mathematical community. They simply don't want to acknowledge that their little pet project no longer has any meaning. It has absolutely zero meaning. So they continue with this facade. And we find this in every branch of science and engineering. If it's the three-blade wind generators, which don't work, solar panels, which don't work, in being installed by vast amounts, the idea that artificial intelligence will run our lives in 5 to 10 years and they will be smarter than people, it's just like the idea that an AI computer can beat somebody in chess. Well, that's simply because they can calculate all of the possible moves, and a person a lot of times plays by instinct. If you remember some of the great chess masters, they would make a move and it would, they had a certain objective in making that move. And if the next person made a reactionary move, then they would then react to that one. And that's what chess is all about. Playing an AI computer is like calculating prime numbers using brute force. It's not, let's say, a satisfying endeavor. And so if that means, oh, well, why play chess anymore because the computer can beat you, then I think we've lost the idea of what chess is all about. Let's take this into another field. Let's go football. Let's imagine that computers started making the calls in a football game because they could more accurately determine what plays would work. So the coach, the guy sitting up in the press box, or the, up there's a box up above where the guy calls the plays and he sends them down to the field and then the quarterback gets them. But these are done by people. If all of a sudden they started replacing these people with computers, then why even go to the game? Because it would be one computer, our team, the Dallas Cowboy computer against the Kansas City Chief computer. And to me, that takes the human-esque part of all of this away. So the people that are saying that, you won't be driving your car in 10 years, believe me, I want my hand on my car wheel, and I want my own car, and I want to drive my car to where I want to go, and I want to park it, and then when I get done doing what I'm doing, I want to come back, and I want to get in my car, and if I want to play chess with somebody, I want to play chess with that person. And it's also a social event. Playing with a computer that's AI programmed that's always going to beat me is not satisfying. It's not a challenge to me because, the computer can go out 2 million options on a move and see what the best move is based on everything that's going on. It's simply not where we should be going. So the people that think that somehow that's wonderful and great, I totally disagree. And I really don't think that people are going to buy into that. They probably will in China. They already are. They probably will in Japan, which is totally overcrowded. But in the good wide open spaces of the United States, I don't see that happening. I see the United States, the public, as being an independent group of people, and I don't see them as caving into this AI is going to run your life deal. Excuse me, it's not going to run my life. I'm going to drive my own car. I'm going to pick my own car. I'm going to own my own car. I'm going to go where I want, when I want. I'm not going to wait on some street corner from some automated car to come and pick me up and take me to some other place. and depend on some system like that, that if they decided someday that I just wasn't going to be in line, or I'd keep, you know, my Google ranking wasn't good enough, that I just wouldn't get a ride that day because I hadn't been a good boy. I hadn't been marching along to the company drumbeat or whatever. So, no, I don't see this as happening. And anybody, I remember when I was a kid, I heard this same thing, that computers were going to run everything. It didn't happen. It still didn't happen. I heard when I was working in the telecommunications industry that knowledge-based computer systems, that's what they called them at the time, now they're calling them AI, automated intelligence, but at the time they were knowledge-based systems, and the belief was that if you got all the experts in a given field together and they put down all of their information into a computer database, then the computer could make all the decisions and we could go off and, you know, let our brains vegetate into nothing because we wouldn't need them anymore because the computer could do it all. One single central computer. And it didn't happen. So the visionaries or the futurists, it might be okay for an Arthur C. Clarke novel, but the reality is that people are people and they're going to continue to be people. And if countries like China want to go the route of automatons, well, so be it. I don't see that happening in the United States. I see people, the people I know, maybe you know a whole different group of people, but there's nobody I know that's going to go off and let some AI computer tell them, you know, how long they're going to wait on a street corner for a car to come and pick them up and take them to some other place. They're going to own their car. They're going to, you know, be independent. And so, and the, you know, just like people riding a horse out in the countryside, you know, if they want to get on their horse, they're going to go ride out in the countryside and ride their horse, you know, not based on some AI decision. Okay, so I could go on and on about that, but leading back to this concept of the large prime number being discovered, it's useless. It's I heard a guy the other day rattling off, in fact, futuristic claims that, here was a good one, that computers could make legal decisions better than attorneys. Therefore, all the attorneys would be out of business in 10 years. Well, I don't see that happening because along with the law, there's a human element to law, and that's what makes law the law. If it were just cut and dried and you broke the law, it's black and white. Well, no. We all know that there are competing laws. There are things that one law says one thing, but then if there's another law that has a conflict, well, how do you resolve that? That's where the human element comes in. And computers are not set up to make those decisions. That's why we have judges. That's why we have people that have attorneys. That's why attorneys take other attorneys to court, is to blend these laws into a workable system that is for people, not automatons. So, as far as futuristic projections, I don't see it happening. It's unfortunate that people have their nose in their phone all the time. Lately, you go around wherever you go to, people are standing there looking at their phone. And I still write things on paper. I still have my hand notes. I still keep my records in written form, etc. And I write complete sentences, not little tweeter sentences or mini sentences. But the other issue is that the mathematical community is really stuck on itself. And I see these groups, science and engineering, especially the Ivory Tower, I see these people basically fading into the woodwork. I see education will be online and people will be able to choose education based on quality, not because somebody tells you that if you go to a certain university, if you go to Harvard, that's better than Cornell, which is better than Yale, which is better than, you know, or some imaginary pecking order. And that's all it is. It's just bragging rights as to who's better, or some small school or the small private schools versus big universities. You know, who's better? I don't see that as the way of the future. I see people getting real information and finding real information sites. That's why a lot of people listen to this show, is because they realize that, you know, what they had learned or what they thought they learned in a textbook simply had no bearing on reality at all. And once you hit that wall, once the door is opened and you peek through for the first time and you go, oh no, oh my goodness, and it's kind of that gotcha moment, that kind of oh blank, fill in the blank, you know, whatever your favorite word is, you know, when you hit the wall and the door opens up and you look out and you go, blank. And that's the moment when people start to discover one thing, then another, then another, then another. And then it's like more doors open up. And then all of a sudden you realize that, you know, you've been marching down the wrong road all your life. And now what do you do? What do you do? And I know people that are, you know, making a stand and living independently. And, you know, it's not easy. It's not easy. It's much easier to work in a corporate environment with a big paycheck and have a nice house. I mean, maybe that's easy. I don't know. But for some people, but for other people, that would be like a jail sentence, a mental jail sentence, to have to work in an environment like that and still, you know, imagine that you're, you know, making your house payment and everything else for the next 25 years, and then you retire and then you die, you know. That's some people's life in a package. But I know other people that, you know, they don't have a retirement. Their retirement is their own work. You know, they're going to maintain good condition, remain healthy, eat good food, own their own, their water source, their food source, live basically a moderate lifestyle. And those are the people that are really happy. It's, like I say, it's not easy. It's not easy doing that because there's uncertainty, but you create your own future. That pioneering venture where you go out, you know, and basically carving, you know, a position on your own land and using it and managing your life. And, you know, you have the ups and the downs and certainly there's uncertainty. But let's talk about the uncertainty in the corporate world, where all of a sudden you're employed, you're doing good, and you have your knees chopped out from underneath you economically when the company decides to have a downsizing. And there you are. You know, talk about uncertainty. Just want to foreshadow something a little bit here. Speaking of uncertainty, in the energy world, there's some major announcements coming up very shortly. And I heard a statistic that solar panels are being installed at a tremendous rate. Now, over the past number of years, three-blade wind generators were being installed at a tremendous rate, you know, 10,000 per year at the very last year. And all of a sudden, they stopped. And why did they stop? Because the government subsidies stopped. Because those things have no ability to economically pay for themselves if it weren't for government subsidies. But finally, the states and the federal government and the local government agencies learned that they are a boondoggle. They simply don't work. They're not economically viable. But a lot of politicians got brownie points for looking green, like putting in wind power, and everybody thought it was a great thing. But what's, for me, very comical is that the installed base of solar panels is increasing. People are putting in solar panels, and this is, I'm not talking about remote farms where they actually store up some of the energy and use it in batteries. I'm talking about the city dweller who puts them on the roof and connects it to the grid and has no batteries to store up the energy. In other words, they're just putting energy out on the grid, and they really don't even use it at their house. They're simply putting that energy on the grid expecting to get a payback. And they're all going to find out that, you know, it just doesn't work. There is no payback. In fact, they'll probably never, ever receive a payback from their investment. But here's the clincher, that the sun only shines a few hours of the day. And I did an analysis, this is in my December paid cast, that let's compare wind, the three-blade wind generators, with solar panels. And I want the general public to listen to this also, because you're being faced with this. I'm seeing advertisements coming out of collusion between government and power companies saying that you can save up to 75% of your electric bill by installing solar panels, and they'll give you a big discount. Well, that's a way for the solar panel companies to sell and install, increase their installation base and get a bit of a kickback from the government. And then I'm sure that there's some federal kickbacks involved in this, or also tax incentives. So everybody's on the incentive, tax incentive, you know, some way this money is flowing through the government. But the reality is probably nobody will ever realize 75% of their electric bill going away or being liquidated by putting solar panels on your house. That is simply a myth. And, you know, maybe one guy, maybe they could find one guy on the planet that eventually did save 75% for maybe 1 month. That might be, you know... but what they're trying to pawn off on you is that this is going to reduce your electric bill by 75%. But first, you got to stick all this money into this program, and that's the clincher, the payback. And if you're not getting that 75% payback, then you're on a monthly basis, then your payback period extends way out there. And like I say, by the time there's any semblance of payback, those solar panels will be defunct. And who's going to take them off your roof? You know, if there's a hailstorm, they're going to be just junk up there. So the issue, however, is that they're trying to force, and this is like a more nefarious goal in the background, they're trying to force people, the people who really understand this, are trying to force the public into investing their money into solar panels. The power companies love it because they control the controllers. They can send out a signal and basically turn off those solar panels that are driving energy into the grid, turn them off, and they actually don't produce anything. So there's cases upon cases where people have put in big investments into their house, putting solar panels on the roof, and they go through a year, and all of a sudden they realize, hey, I'm not getting any benefit from these solar panels. And they come back and say, well, yeah, that's because the power company. So the people that sold them to you put it off on the power company and say, well, the power company did not allow you to turn those on. And at that point, the people realize that, you know, they have been caught between the middle, the crossfire. The people that sold it to them say, well, it's the power company. And the power company looks back and they go, well, that's just the way we work things around here. So people are going to find out the hard way. But see, what's going on here is, now imagine this homeowner. He just dropped $20,000 to $30,000 into this set of solar panels and all the controllers and everything else that go with it, and never going to receive a payback. Do you think he's going to go out and do this again? No, it's like being bitten by the neighbor's dog. You know, do you think you're going to go out and walk by the neighbor's house again without a stick? You know, no, you're aware now that you've been bitten by the economic divisiveness of the alternative energy industry, and you're not going to do it again. So that's the goal, is to prime people so that they will not invest in anything that does work, because they've been duped into this deal of buying solar panels. And the end result, however, is let's imagine that they make a solar panel that is 100% efficient. It takes all of the sun's energy that hits it and turns it into electricity. And this, is, of course, is never going to happen. But say you did. And say you made that solar panel for, oh, let's say 20 cents a watt, which is way, way below the market value right now. And so a couple of years ago, it was $2 a watt. So if you bought a 400-watt panel, it was $800 for that panel. If you bought a 80-watt panel, it was $160. Well, the prices have come down. But let's imagine that you could build that 100% efficient solar panel for 20 cents a watt. So you could have a 400-watt panel that would cost you $80. So anyway, imagine this really unrealistic scenario, but say that the solar industry came out with something like this. Now, to eventually make use of this and to have what I've called distributed energy, and of course, this is the pretend goal here in this whole thing. People are imagining that somewhere down the line, maybe their kids will have solar panels someday, and we won't be paying this central power company. And therein lies the myth. Because if you had solar panels and you got rid of that central power company, which is the undefined goal here, that's kind of what they're always implying by, I get a kick out of the American Wind Energy Association. They wanted 30% of America's energy generated by wind by the year 2050. Well, 2050... hey, anybody on that board is going to be dead long before then, so their promises can be as vacuous as can be. But the payback for this imaginary goal of replacing the power company is what we're talking about here. But to do that with solar panels, you need batteries. You need a storage mechanism, and that is where the rub is. Now, so if you had to buy batteries, here's the problem. Let's just take a look at it. You put solar panels on your house enough to cover all of your daily supply of energy. Okay, so the sun only shines a certain number of hours per day. I don't care where you live, sunny Phoenix, you know, the most brilliant tropical island down near the equator, doesn't matter. The sun only has a certain number of viable hours per day on average, and then you have some cloudy days. And so when you time average that over the year, the industry has come up with the number of what they call solar hours per day, and that's four. There are four solar hours per day in a good location, like Phoenix, Arizona, or something like that. So on average, every day for 365 days a year, this is averaged out over a year, including rainy days and everything else, you have 4 hours of sun per day. So now you would have to buy a battery pack that would store up enough energy to cover the other 20 hours in that day. So you have 4 hours of gathering energy time and 20 hours of time. And by the way, during that 4 hours, you're using energy too at the same rate. And so you have to subtract that off of those 4 hours. And so you need excess solar panels to grab enough energy to store up in your batteries so that you can cover those extra 20 hours per day. But Now you have periods when it will be cloudy for 2, 3, 4 days in a row. So your battery pack is not just limited to that 20 hours, but it has to be 20 hours plus 24 plus 24 plus 24. So another 72 hours of battery capacity to power your home. Do you see how impossible this is? Even given the impossible fact that you have 100% efficient solar panels at 20 cents per watt, a ridiculous number that I don't think you would ever see. You might see 20% per watt maybe someday, but you will never see 100% efficient solar panels. And so the end result is that you don't have enough room on your roof or in your yard to put the solar panels to collect enough energy to drive your home at the rate of energy usage that we see today. So the end result is we're never going to get rid of that central power company using solar panels. And the people in the industry know that. They're out there to sell you something, and the end game that is really unspoken is that you're going to invest your money, and the more money you put into solar panels, and that's why the counties and people are doing this stupidly. The people that run the counties and the power companies, they're just out there to sell you something because they're all getting part of the money flow that's coming back from federal kickbacks, incentives, tax incentives, subsidies, whatever you want to call them. They're all getting part of this money flow because the wind energy industry has already woken up to the fact that three-blade wind generators don't work. And so they've cut the subsidies. Nobody's putting in wind generators anymore. You'll see some going in, but the installed base in the United States now is 88,000. That's where it's going to stop. And what have they done? They've basically sucked all of the money that's available for alternative energy. They've sucked it out, put it in their pocket, and now they're going away. And there's no more subsidies, and nobody in government is going to be stupid enough to invest in alternative energy, especially wind, because they know that they don't work. And that's the problem when most of you know that I'm coming along with the wind generator. And the only problem is, as far as they're concerned, is that the wind generator does not need government subsidies. It stands on its own 2 feet. But what's the funny part here is that solar, given that there's only 4 sun hours per day to charge up the solar panels, that it can beat wind, which blows 24 hours a day. That tells you how ridiculously bad the three-blade wind generators are. They can't make energy. given 24-hour availability of wind in some of these really windy places that are set around the country. So it just tells you how ludicrous this whole situation is. Anyway, I wanted to divert there because there's some major announcements coming up soon. And anyway, just to keep tuned for that, I wanted to kind of prime the pump, so to speak. Just an update on some space activity this week. The National Reconnaissance Office launched another spy satellite from Vandenberg Air Force Base on a Delta rocket, and apparently all went well. But back in the 50s, there was an accord set to keep military out of outer space. In other words, to keep the ventures in outer space for strictly civilian or peaceful purposes. And, of course, for national security reasons, etc. And the military always justifies their presence. It's like if way back in the beginning when wars first started and armies first crossed borders to take land and resources, etc., that there was an accord set by everybody that there would be only certain weapons used, hand weapons of a certain style made out of wood, not metal, But as soon as this one-upmanship began between armies, where one army would get an advantage over the other, and then the other one would return with a different advantage or counter-advantage, etc., as soon as that one-upmanship began, the world of militarism and the military-industrial complex, whether it was old Rome or Carthage, or whether it was the United States and Russia, the military-industrial complex gained hold and was firmly seated in place. So outer space is the next great warfare frontier. And in my book, The Diamond Principle, I talk about the fact that when you go into outer space, it's very different. And if you are a military strategist, you should take heed that never before have we had a three-dimensional frontier. Even if you look at airplanes and the air wars, as soon as they were able to fly, one of the dominant aspects of warfare was aircraft. And played the primary role in World War I, but more so in World War II. But the use of outer space is even different than that, because that concentrated on activity that was relatively close to the ground. Planes could shoot each other down, but the objective was to destroy things on the ground. And, of course, in outer space, here is the problem. You have three dimensions, and if you're in low Earth orbit, well, you're in a sense like an airplane. You're still directing your activity towards the ground. But eventually, once you start going out into three-dimensional space, the reality of funding this and supplying it and supporting it becomes overbearing. And so the country that does not do anything militaristic in outer space, that puts all of its effort into civilian programs, will eventually go farther and faster, and those with the burden of military will just simply outweigh themselves and will fall behind and will not be able to succeed. So that's a difficult concept to get your head around, but three-dimensional warfare is much different than two-dimensional, because it's growing as the cube of the volume, not the square of the surface. Well, think about that a little bit if you're a mathematician or mathematically minded. So just once again, remember my webpage, jmccsci.com. The paid casts are there, the $3.95 a month, and the water filters are there, new, very easy to use drop down menus on the web ordering page. Go there, my webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.